From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thomas Boswell has 99 reasons why baseball is better than football. He won't give us all 99 on today's Fresh Air, but the Washington Post sports writer will tell us why he loves the game and loves to write about it. Also today, we take a voyage into the mind of Jonathan Winters. For years, Winters has been delighting fans with his self-created cast of characters. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the British rock group The Small Faces, and book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel from East German journalist Crystal Wolf. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In the essay, Why Time Begins on Opening Day, Tom Boswell wrote that at the start of each season, we know that something fine, almost wonderful, is about to begin, but we can't say why baseball seems so valuable, almost indispensable to us. Well, maybe so, but fans of good sports writing think Boswell has come as close as anyone to describing the pleasures of the game. Boswell is a sports columnist at the Washington Post, where he's worked for 20 years. He's also a contributor to NPR's Morning Edition. His new book, The Heart of the Order, is his third collection of baseball pieces. One of the pieces is called 99 Reasons Why Baseball is Better Than Football.
Some people say football's the best game in America. Others say baseball. Some people are really dumb. Pro football's a great game compared to hockey. Here are the first 99 reasons why baseball is better than football. More after lunch. Bands. Halftime with bands. Cheerleaders at halftime with bands. Up with people singing The Impossible Dream during a Blue Angels flyover at halftime with bands. Baseball has fans in Wrigley Field singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game at the seventh inning stretch. Baseball has Blue Boone Odom, Catfish, Spaceman, and the Sugar Bear. Football has Lester the Molester, Too Mean, and the Assassin. Baseball has a bullpen coach blowing bubblegum with his cap turned around backward while leaning on a fungo bat. Football has a defensive coordinator in a satin jacket with a headset and a clipboard. Earl Weaver steals third base and won't give it back. Tom Landry folds his arms. No one has ever actually reached the end of the restroom line at an NFL game. Marianne Moore loved Christy Mathewson. No woman of quality has ever preferred football to baseball. The best football announcer ever was Howard Cosell. The worst baseball announcer ever was Howard Cosell. All gridirons are identical. Football coaches never have to meet to go over the ground rules.
This is a very convincing case, I think.
We can rest, and we haven't even gotten up to brunch much yet lunch.
You also write that more good baseball books appear in a single year than have been written about football in the past 50 years. As a writer who focuses on baseball and on golf,
yes.
Why do you think that baseball is maybe better to write about than football?
George Plimpton has a wonderful small ball theory of writing, that nothing good has ever been written about beach balls, not much about basketball. You'd move down through football, but once you get to tennis and baseball, it gets better. And the best short story ever may have been Mark Twain's Leaping Frog of Calaveras County, I guess it was, and that's about gunshot, which is smaller than any of them. I don't think it has anything to do with ball size, actually. I think baseball has three or four things going for it that make it a particularly open game to writers. One is that the game is analytically open. You can see everything that's going on in it. You don't have to watch game films like football coaches do. Second, it's daily. It happens every day. It's not a warlike warlike ceremony. It's more like a daily activity that mirrors the way most people live their lives. It's a game that's open to normal-sized people. I think that makes the game accessible to millions of people, not those that can identify with being 7 feet tall. Actually, the reasons just go on and on. That's why there are so many good books.
You know, you say baseball measures a gift for dailiness, and surely that's true in the game, but it must also be true in baseball journalism. That you have to have that gift for dailiness as much as the players do.
I think that people who write about baseball are sort of mistakenly called writers. I think we're far more reporters. I've been at the Post for 20 years, and I've been doing baseball for 15 years. And I think what charms me most is going to the ballpark 100 or more times a year And knowing that there'll be people there to talk to, stories to swap, anecdotes to tell, it's so rich compared to other sports that it's hard to believe. If you have any passion for details, the telling anecdote, the little twists of character that are only revealed when you're around a person for years, baseball has a great advantage over other games in that. And I think the dailiness is becomes a kind of creative addiction. For years, I wrote 200 to 230 pieces a year for the Post, and it's interesting, there came a point in my career when a national magazine offered me similar compensations to write about 20 pieces a year, and I couldn't bear to leave. I'd rather write every day. And I think that part of that is the ball player wants to be judged every day because he thinks in the long run his good work will come forward. His 0 for 5 will not be remembered because all the other days when he went a constructive 1 for 3 with a walk and a stolen base will show up. I think from a writer's point of view, if you're there every day, the string piles up. It sort of weaves itself into a rope. You feel that the material gains strength by the density of your saturation in the detail of the game.
You still feel that way?
I really do. In fact, that decision not to write 20 a year but to continue to write 150 a year was just made a few months ago.
Now, most of the time you've been writing in Washington, you've been writing in a city without a home team.
That's my greatest advantage as a baseball writer.
Why?
I've always said that Sherlock Holmes was, or Conan Doyle said that Sherlock Holmes was the world's only consulting private detective. Nobody else had exactly that bizarre job description. And I'm the only daily baseball writer in a city without a team. Actually, I write a general column, but I'm in a position to write about whatever is hot, whatever is most interesting. I don't have to cover one team 100 or 150 times. If Pete Rose is on trial for his life, so to speak, or on a 44-game hitting streak, then I can go and follow that. If there's a wonderful series between two competing teams, I can follow that. When I go to spring training, I can go to see Jim Abbott pitch his first game. And that freedom to go anywhere and talk about everything is just wonderful. And to be able to do it on a daily basis where you have timeliness, you don't have to appear several days late or a month late as you would if you wrote for some magazines, and also to have the freedom to go anywhere and do anything is really rich.
Tom Boswell is my guest, and he's a sports columnist for the Washington Post, and a collection of his baseball pieces from 1983 to 1988 have just been collected in the new book, The Heart of the Order. You've been writing about baseball for about 25 years now, and in that time, you've gotten older, and in that sense, it's been like watching the baseball players get younger, I'd imagine. I wonder if your attitude toward the players have changed as your age relationship has changed.
That's interesting. I've been at the Post 20 years, and I'm 41, so I'm now older than some of the players, but it's odd. Tommy John is still 5 years older than I am, so I still feel that I'm part of the generation that's playing. I think over the next 10 years, I will feel some of that sense of losing people that I came into the game with. I think one of the things that's important is to meet the new generation on its own terms. That is, whenever I go to see a new a team that I haven't been to in a while, I always try to find one or two people who are not part of the story I'm working on, simply to meet them. When I went to see the Pittsburgh Pirates last year, there wasn't particularly any reason to talk to Spanky LaValliere, their catcher, except that I had never seen a player who was short, fat, bald, and an all-star. I'd never seen anybody with all those bad characteristics who was that good. So I got to know Spanky. I think that that's something that you probably have to work on as you get older. I haven't really felt it acutely yet. Actually, what I have felt is that it's much easier to talk to general managers and owners as you're older.
Oh, because you're less easily intimidated by their authority?
No, I was never really intimidated by baseball owners' authority. They always seemed as much amusing as powerful. But they tend to respect a receding hairline. And that's not, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me when you were younger, maybe you had, maybe the baseball players were more like heroes to you than they'd be now. One, because you're a veteran of the game yourself, and two, because you're older than a lot of them are.
I always thought that when I came to baseball writing there, you would often hear people talk about the two schools of writing about athletes, that you either looked up to them or down at them. And I never understood that. I never saw what was wrong with just looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
That's really how I started, and that's how I continue to feel. I come from a family of librarians. Both my parents were librarians, and my mother was a writer, too. And My father, an amateur pen and ink artist, and I loved sports and played them and was mediocre at everything. But I was not raised to be an athlete or to think that that was something marvelous to be. I always felt that that being a good writer was as dignified as being a good athlete or being a good craftsman at anything. So I never came to sports thinking that I was better or worse than the people I was talking to, merely that they were a very, very interesting subject to write about.
You've watched a lot of baseball players have to retire because of their age. And you have a very interesting piece about Jim Palmer, for instance, in the new collection. You want to describe a little bit about what it was like when...
Yeah. I covered Palmer, I guess, the last 9 or 10 years of his career, and I found him almost as complex as anyone I've ever met. His everything about him that shows on the outside is the opposite of what he really is. He's a complete self-driven, demanding perfectionist. He has insomnia. He'll wake up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and go to help work on the patio of a friend at 5 a.m. He's terribly clean living. At any rate, you would think that someone who was so smart, so stylish, had so many options after his career, could be a front man for Jockey Underwear or a national TV analyst, would not feel the wrench of the game. He had always sort of pretended to be above it. And yet the morning he retired, he didn't really retire. He was fired. And everyone tried to put a good face on it, but that just wasn't the way it was. And he actually took the podium, tried to say goodbye, and broke down crying and literally ran off the podium and out of Memorial Stadium, just the way he used to jog off the mound when Earl Weaver used to come out and take the ball. Anyone who's ever seen him would see how he would lope down off the mound. That's just how he loped out of his retirement announcement. And it was interesting to me to compare him with another player on that same team, John Lowenstein, who was a journeyman. And Lowenstein retired with great dignity, with a great sense of amusement. There was no mourning at all. He felt he'd gotten everything out of his talent. Palmer still thought that he could continue to pitch. So to me, there may not have been a grand moral with a capital M, but I thought that there was something both poignant but also kind of sweet in Lowenstein's ability to go out with complete dignity. And it was also nice to see how much Palmer really loved the game, that apparent distance, that sophistication, wasn't some extent a veneer, and that he felt the game deeply and loved it deeply.
When you watched Palmer run out of that press conference because there were tears in his eyes, did you think to yourself, well, I'll never be forced to retire because of my age. I won't have to leave the sport when I reach a certain age.
I've always thought that it was terribly unfair that if a doctor or a lawyer or anyone in any profession had to leave arbitrarily when they were 35 or 40, I can't imagine anything crueler. And there really is a sense that athletes face a double death. But I do remember when I saw Palmer run out, I thought the better they are, the harder they fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think the more you succeed at anything, the more attached you become to it, because it feeds you, it reinforces you. You tend to fall into the trap of thinking of yourself as being that thing rather than being yourself. And when that thing, that description of you as a lawyer or a senator or a teacher or whatever, when it's taken away from you for whatever reason, you feel like part of yourself is stolen. And I think there's athletes should play more defense against that, should know better, and don't. But probably we all ought to play some defense against it. Yeah. I remember Kenny Holtzman of the old Oakland A's said, I swear I'll never fall into the trap of thinking I'm a ball player.
When did you fall in love with baseball?
Oh, I guess when I was about 8 years old.
Did you have a father who'd play catch with you and all that stuff?
My father was an academic. He recited Paradise Lost. So I doubt if I ever played catch with my father. He was a good enough sport to probably go to a couple of ball games with me, and I think he once just about broke his leg in half trying to slide into home plate in a game, and he probably hadn't done it in 40 years. So I appreciated the effort. But the thing that was nice about baseball is I played disorganized baseball. My parents neither approved it nor disapproved it. When the homework was done, that was something that was mine. And because it was so much mine and not theirs, maybe my delight in it was never driven away. I wasn't driven toward it or away from it. I still remember those wonderful days when you don't play in Little League or Babe Ruth League, and you go out and you play all day and hit 17 home runs, and then come back home at dusk and smell dinner cooking. To me, that's boyhood for me.
Did you read the sports pages carefully when you were young?
My father once took me up to the level of the stacks at the Library of Congress when I was about 11 years old. And he snuck me in because it was against the rules. And he said, "Okay, Tom, here is every book on baseball that has ever been written. Don't go blind." And I think I spent about 2 or 3 years when I was 11, 12, 13. I probably was the only boy in America who literally knew where to go to find every baseball book ever written. There aren't many I don't think I didn't read.
Well, I want to find out how you started writing about sports, but first we're going to take a short break. Sports columnist Tom Boswell is my guest, and he's been at the Washington Post for about 20 years now. His columns from 1983 to 88 are collected in the new book, The Heart of the Order. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
In addition to the aforementioned credentials, my guest Tom Boswell is also a commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. When you told your parents that you wanted to write about sports, did your librarian parents think that this was the occupation that they'd hoped for their son?
They wondered why they had bothered to pay for private school and Amherst College, and I probably wondered why I had taken 5 buses a day for 6 or 7 years to go to that school, or wait on tables to go through that college. Actually, it was an accident. I had a bad basketball injury, and the Navy wouldn't take me, and there was sort of a gap between semesters in school, and I assumed I was going to go to law school, and I said, well, I'll get off the academic grind for a few months and do something to amuse myself. And so I walked into the sports department of the Post and said, you must need somebody to fetch hamburgers and add up box scores and answer the phones, and I need to make a buck for a few months. And I hadn't been there very long when I sensed that I better find out more about it. And I fell in love with the process of being a reporter, not being around sports. That didn't impress me much. I had played sports. That wasn't the big deal. The thing that interested me was that I discovered I was a reporter. I loved details. I loved finding out why things happened. I loved interviewing people, and they seemed to like talking to me. I liked doing homework before talking to someone, and discovering that the more you know about someone, the more likely they are to open up to you, that they realize if you had the concern to find out about them before you talk to them, you will also, they presume, take care with them in dealing with them when you write about them. That same, sincerity will show up in the writing. So the thing that that surprised me was that I came to the Post thinking that I was a writer, and stayed to discover that I was more a journalist.
When you first started doing locker room interviews with players, I'm sure you were tested in one way or another to see whether you were worthy of speaking honestly to. What were some of the ways that you were tested in those early days?
It's interesting that I think if players feel that you're passionate about understanding the game, appreciating it, valuing it, if the game, in this case baseball, is your primary interest and not sensationalizing their contract dispute or stirring the pot in their war with the manager, etc., that they will come to trust you after the first or second or third story. That was another great advantage because I did not have to. Now, I've covered beats and local beats where those sorts of problems appeared and where you have to deal with them, and that's another problem. But in baseball, I was always writing about towns that were 100 or 1,000 or 3,000 miles away. And I think those, first of all, the players were surprised to see somebody there from another town. They assumed that you must have an inordinate interest to take the trouble to be there. They also figured because you were from 500 miles away, you probably didn't have an axe to grind or a side to take. And so I think there were natural built-in advantages there. And they would give you credit and sometimes say things to you that they would not say to their own hometown reporters. There might be a case of familiarity breeding contempt. Also, when I would come to those come to games under those circumstances, I would almost never start off by asking about whatever the controversy of the day was. If I was doing a piece on baseball bats, the history of the bat, or what you looked for in a perfect bat, or how a batting stance correlated to the personality of the person in that stance. I would start off with something that was more directly about the game and that I loved and that I was, in fact, working on. And after talking about that, I think there's a sort of a tone established, and then you say, okay, now I realize there's also a controversy here on this team. Your manager just punched you yesterday or whatever it is. Now, what do you have? Is there something you want to say about that? I'll ask you the standard questions and tell me if you have something to say about that. But I don't think it's a badgering sort of interviewing. Veteran established ball players are not going to say more than they are willing to say. The question is, do they trust who they're talking to? It's not the brilliance of the question. It's simply whether they decide they want to talk about it then and to you. And if they're not ready to talk about it, they're not going to.
Those are all really interesting points. When you started writing, were there cliches in sports writing that you vowed you would never use yourself?
I think I was in danger in the other direction. I was an overwriter. I had probably been exposed to too much Yeats. And with the years, I tried to write more like Raymond Chandler and less like Dostoevsky, and found that suited my level of talent a lot better. Raymond Chandler once said, in trying how to figure out how to pace a detective novel, he said, "When in doubt, have a man come through a door with a gun." And in writing sports journalism, I've often followed the same thing. Please do not describe the sunset. Look through your material and see if you have any men with any guns to bring through the door. And I've also discovered that I'm much less prone to read novels and biographies now, and much more to read essayists like Montaigne, or letters of people like Emerson or Keats. Letters tend to be very pungent. Or aphorists like Nietzsche, or poets like Rambo, who have an incredible capacity to synthesize and say a great deal in a very few words. Those larger sort of architectural or orchestral skills for handling large lengths, writing a 300-page novel, I'm somewhat in awe of that. I don't quite know how that's done and how that's made to work. And my skills tend to be aphoristic, and maybe the skills of an essayist.
Let me ask you an issue-oriented question pertaining to Pete Rose and the charges against him that he has participated in gambling on baseball, perhaps even gambling on games that he was involved with. You have two pieces that Pete Rose, well, at least two that Pete Rose figures into in the new collection. And let me just quote a couple of things that you've written about him over the years. You've said, "Because he has loved the game for its own sake, on its own terms, the game loves him back and cannot cease rewarding him." And then you wrote, "The middle-aged boy who epitomizes effort, enthusiasm, and the willed refusal to grow up." That's how you described him. Then you said, on the other hand, he's always looking for an edge, a buck, or a plug. Do the new charges against Pete Rose change your attitude towards him from what you've written about him
before?
He
is fascinating. First of all, I wanted to tell a story about him. When I was 15 years ago, when I started traveling around to games, ball players don't tend to remember who you are from one time to another. They think the Washington Post is near Seattle. Pete Rose knew every groundskeeper in baseball, every batting coach. If you were unpretentious and unimportant, Pete Rose knew you. And a year or two before any other player in baseball knew my name, when I would come up to Pete Rose and put out my hand, he'd say, "Tom Boswell, Washington Post," because I would always reintroduce myself. That's typical of Rose's generosity with little people. That's one point. Second, if it is found that Rose has a serious gambling problem, even a gambling addiction, that will not put him in any different category than Fyodor Dostoevsky, who gambled himself into jail and had a similar problem. A third point, we give drug addicts in baseball 28 days to rehabilitate themselves. If Pete Rose turns out to have been a gambling addict and to have bet on games, including his own team, which would, if it's true, would be the logical result of being a gambling addict, we will not give him 28 days. He'll get life.
We know you make the point in one of your essays that the longer you write about baseball, the less you rely on statistics and the more you're interested in psychology. And probably thinking about Pete Rose is an example of that.
Mm-hmm. I think the way people change over time is one of the most fascinating things in writing about baseball. And I think one of the game may not have ceased loving him in some ways, but it may have played a dirty trick on him in another. For 30 years, America told him, "Pete, you are wonderful. Stay a child. Stay enthusiastic. We love your joy, your bumptiousness, your silliness, the fact that you probably stay up all night watching other games on cable TV. Please don't damage your mind with anything except baseball. Don't grow up. And he obeyed. He did not grow up. He stayed about 16 years old. Also, most of us sometimes in our 20s get some humility beaten into our heads. I remember covering the same high school football game 6 years in a row, and the sixth year saying, boy, I sure am moving up in this profession quick. Ball players tend to have that same sort of humility administered in their 30s as they get older. The expression is he learned to say hello just as it was time to say goodbye. And a lot do learn to say hello, that is, have some real-world modesty in their 30s. Rose just went the other way. He was a star who became a superstar in his late 30s because he got huge contracts, helped the Phillies win the pennant in 1980. Then he passed Stan Musial. Then he got 4,000 hits. He became an international star. And by the time he was passing Ty Cobb, around 45, he was a world figure. All the things that would help him wean himself from the game and stop being childlike were, in a sense, denied him because his career peaked in terms of fame later than any player I've ever heard of. So his arrested adolescence is probably more radical than any ball player I can think of. To his credit, I will say that he had never pretended that he was not a real rough-edged guy. He never pretended that he didn't fool around. He never pretended that he didn't go to the track and love it. He never pretended to highbrow tastes. He was as open to messing up as a regular Joe. So he'll be saved to some degree in the public mind because he'll never be perceived as a hypocrite, which may be a problem Steve Garvey will face.
Do you see your own writing in baseball terms? And by that I mean, do you ever feel like you're on a winning streak or a losing streak? Do you have the equivalent of an average that you give yourself on your pieces?
That's interesting. I sometimes get hot. That is interesting, and I seldom notice it at the time. And then I'll go back when I'm putting a collection together or something, and I have to drag out the clip files from 5 years, and I'll go through 2 months of pieces, and there'll just be nothing there that's any good. And I'll say, how did I go through this without noticing that everything here was just junk? And then I'll come to 3 or 4 pieces in a row, and they'll all end up in a book. And I don't know how that works or why. One of the nice things about writing for a newspaper and getting to come back the next day or the day after and continue to write is I think that your mediocre pieces, they cause you pain while you're writing them. You know they're not working, but you have to let them go and say, okay, that's it. We'll try again tomorrow. Sometimes bothers you when you think there was more potential there. But the odd thing to me is that I so seldom know when I'm writing well at that time. In fact, I've taken to saying to my editors, when they say, should I take this out, should I change that, I say, don't ask me, I'll be the last one to know.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us about writing and about baseball. Thank you very much.
Really fun.
My guest has been Tom Boswell, and his new book, The Heart of the Order, is published by Doubleday. It's a collection of his baseball pieces from his past 5 years of columns he's written for The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth, the rhythm section of the band Talking Heads. They have their own group, Tom Tom Club, and they have a new album and will begin a tour in May. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When you say hello to Jonathan Winters, there's really no telling who'll answer. Maybe a lecherous grandmother, maybe a shoot-first-think-later Marine. Since the early days of television, Winters' improvisations have delighted audiences. Coming up, we meet Jonathan Winters. Remember the British group Small Faces? They only had one big hit in this country, Ichiku Park. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us what happened to them before and after. And book critic John Leonard reviews Accident, A Day's News. It's journalist Crystal Wolfe's novel about a writer in Eastern Europe on the day she hears the news about Chernobyl. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Final arguments began today in the Iran-Contra trial of Oliver North, NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Prosecutor John Kecker told the jury, the tragedy of Oliver North is that a man who cared so much about freedom and democracy in Nicaragua forgot about the demands of freedom and democracy at home. Kecker said, nowhere in this case is there a better picture of Oliver North than in the false letters he drafted for his boss, Robert McFarlane, to send to Congress. It was intended to throw Congress off the track. North and McFarlane, said the prosecutor, were following Adolf Hitler's strategy. The victor will never be asked if he told the truth. Defense lawyer Brendan Sullivan reacted to that with rage. Anyone who would link Colonel North to Adolf Hitler is not credible, said Sullivan, and should not be believed. It is sick, it is twisted, and everything the government sees in this case, they see through a dirty glass. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
Swiss police today arrested Adnan Khashoggi and Barron at the insistence of the U.S. government. Khashoggi, a wealthy Saudi Arabian businessman, is wanted in the U.S. in connection with swindles orchestrated by former Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos. The U.S. has 60 days to submit a formal request to the Swiss asking for Khashoggi's return to American soil. House Speaker Jim Wright asked the Ethics Committee today to produce all the documents relating to the allegations against him. The Speaker made the request as the Ethics Committee continues to investigate one last allegation against Wright. NPR's Cookie Roberts has more.
Jim Wright pledged today to fight and win against the charges by the Ethics Committee. And today the Speaker spent some time refuting one of those charges, that he received gifts up to $145,000 from Fort Worth businessman George Malik. The largest share of those gifts, Betty Wright's salary over 4 years. Wright today produced evidence which he said showed his wife worked for her pay and was worth the $18,000 she received annually. And the Speaker raised the specter of congressional scrutiny into all spouses' employment, something many members argued was out of the bounds of the Ethics Committee. But even while defending Wright, several Democrats admitted they will wait to form a judgment to see what the Ethics Committee eventually decides and what the voters at home are judging in the court of public opinion. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
A secret meeting between the leaders of Israel and Hungary today failed to produce a breakthrough in relations between the two countries. NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Jerusalem that the unprecedented meeting fell short of Israeli expectations.
Last night, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir left on a secret trip to Hungary, believing, according to Israeli sources, that the result might be the resumption of full diplomatic relations, the first such move by an Eastern Bloc European country since the Soviet Union and its allies broke relations with Israel in 1967 after the Six-Day War. According to Hungarian and Israeli sources, however, difficulties developed over trade issues and the question of an international peace conference on the Palestinian issue. The Soviet Union supports an international conference. Israel opposes it. The Hungarian Jewish community is the largest in Eastern Europe, and this is also believed to be a part of the motivation behind Shamir's trip. Another notable fact is that he was accompanied to Hungary by Justice Minister Dan Meridor, not Foreign Minister Moshe Aron. The presence of Meridor appears to solidify his position as Shamir's closest advisor and the author of many of Shamir's policies, including his recent plan for elections in the Israeli-occupied territories. This is John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
Comedian Lucille Ball is listed in very serious condition at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. The 77-year-old Ball was rushed to surgery today after suffering an apparent heart attack. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 42 points to close at 2379.04. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The British band Small Faces were contemporaries of the Beatles, Rolling Stones, and The Who, but Small Faces didn't endure as well as the competition. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward tells us why.
Despite what you hear record collectors saying, Americans got to hear most of the best bands of the British invasion. And despite problems with the immigration folks in the Musicians Union, the British who invaded were made welcome on America's stages and charts. Still, there was an exception, a huge one, even though none of the guys in the band stood over 5'6" tall, the Small Faces. The Small Faces were whipped into existence by Steve Marriott, who'd left home at 14 to devote full time to being a child actor in London's West End. Like most child actors, his career ended when his voice changed, but by then he'd discovered pop music and the mod movement. After a few unsuccessful tries at recording, he found Kenny Jones, Ronnie Lane, and Jimmy Winston, and everything clicked. A few gigs and they had a manager, and then a recording contract.
I want you to know that I love you, baby. I want you to know that I care. I'm so happy when you're around me, but I'm sad when you're not there. Sing the song now. What you gonna do?
What you gonna do about it was only a top 20 hit, but it got the Small Faces noticed. When a second single, I've Got Mine, failed to do anything, though, Marriott unleashed the ruthless side of his personality and fired organist Jimmy Winston, replacing him with a youngster named Ian McClagan. This would prove to be the classic combination, and almost immediately, they were a hit.
Picked her up on a Friday night, sha-la-la-la-lee, yeah. I knew everything gonna be all right, sha-la-la-la-lee, yeah, sha-la-la-la-lee. I asked her, where do you want her go, sha-la-la-la-lee, yeah.
Sha-la-la-la-lee went to number 3 in England, and screaming mobs met the four tiny mods all over the country, although in the U.S. their records went unnoticed. This may have been what caused the band to end their deal with Decca Records and sign with Immediate, a label started by Rolling Stones manager Andrew Lug Oldham. Having the Faces was quite a coup for Immediate, and they were given the full treatment and allowed unlimited time in the studio to experiment, which in 1967 was just what a band wanted.
Here come the nights, looking so good. He makes me feel like no one else could. He knows what I want, he's got what I need. He's always there if I need some speed. Here come the night,
it's understood.
Here come the night,
it makes me feel so good. I'd
be just like you.
Their hits tended to be cute folk rock types of things like Here Comes the Nice that fit in well with their over-the-top Bo Brummel-style outfits. And it was this sort of psychedelic fairy tale quality that gave them their only U.S. hit in 1967.
Over Bridge of Sighs, to rest my eyes in shades of green, under dreaming spires, to Ichiku Park, that's where I've been. What did you do there? What did you feel there?
Well, I cried.
But why the tears there?
Tell you why.
It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful.
I feel inclined to blow my mind guitar.
Ichiku Park was like a real bummer for people who'd been following this group since it was a tight R&B outfit. And although it led the Byrds to mention them in 8 Miles High, where they sing, "In places small faces are found," it also led their arch-rival, Pete Townsend of The Who, to scathe them at every opportunity. And the drug references managed to get them banned from U.S. airwaves from then on, which was too bad because in 1968, they found the right balance between Ronnie Lane's folkiness and Steve Marriott's screaming.
Wouldn't it be nice to get on with me neighbours? But they make it very clear they've got no room for ravers.
We'd entered the era when statements were what counted, and soon the small faces were in the studio making one. The trouble was, they were doing that instead of touring America, watching their belly buttons instead of their bank accounts. They put out a concept album, Ogden's Nut Gone Flake, in a round cover, and then, realizing they'd gone stale, broke up, leaving behind a great last single, Afterglow.
No one can deny us. People who once passed me by will turn their heads round. I'm happy just to be with you and loving you the way I do. There's everything I need to know, just resting in the afterglow of your
Marriott went on to found Humble Pie, and of course the rest of the faces went with Rod Stewart. But they sure were great when they were still small.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. This is Fresh Air. George Burns once said that Jonathan Winters is the only one of us who never has to worry about somebody stealing his stuff. Nobody else could do it. When Jonathan Winters came onto the comedy scene in the mid-1950s, there was no one else like him. He did free-associating improvisations in which he'd slip into different characters. The characters were all creations of his imagination, and he gave each one a different voice and set of facial expressions. Winters was a popular guest on all the TV talk shows in the 50s and 60s and starred in several movies. But for many years, he's kept out of the public eye, with the exception of trash bag commercials and occasional TV appearances and movie roles. But 2 years ago, Winters' collection of short stories became a surprise bestseller. He followed that with a book of his paintings. In the introduction, Winters said painting was always a way for him to hide. His childhood was lonely and unhappy, and he used his art, like he would later use his comedy, as a way to freely express himself.
Every once in a while, you find a man or a woman that had not only a strange childhood, but maybe they weren't allowed to be children. I thought for a long time, I still do, that I was a grown-up. Not that I was grown up intellectually. It took me quite a while to mature, and I still am in that respect. But as far as being an adult, I felt that I was an adult when I was about seven. I thought, boy, I was more. I was an elderly man. I was a little old child in many ways. And it wasn't until a number of years later, well into my 40s, that I decided, boy, now's the time to be a kid again, to wear these funny costumes. I remember my father was always saying, you're not going outside dressed like that, are you? And I didn't think it was that different. I had on sort of a rubber claw that was on my hand, and I had a bandana around my head so that it made me some kind of a militant. Before militants were really militants and fashionable or terrorists, I had on heavy shades and maybe a white stick and a dead monkey on my shoulder. And he said, why do you dress like this? Why? You merely draw attention to yourself. And I said, well, that's what I'm looking for. I'm obviously not getting it from you, so I'll have to try to get it in front of the post office.
Were any of the characters that you created characters who you saw yourself as, characters that really came out of your own personal life?
Well, I think probably out of my own personal life, Chester Honeyhugger is the character that's basically me, that was in all through school, sort of struggling and failing and passing now and then and looking out the window and looking at girls and the teacher saying, Chester, are you paying attention? You're not, are you? You wonder why you fail. Why do you constantly look out the window? It's snowing, isn't it, class? Everybody, it's snowing. Yeah, it is snowing. And I'd rather be out there on a flexible flyer. I'd rather be in the snow. I'd have a lot more fun. And I was noticing the woodpecker put his beak in the tree. He probably gets more maple sugar than anybody, any other bird.
Why do you say that? Why do you say that?
I guess because I want to be an ornithologist.
Where did you learn that word?
I don't know, but I know it's right.
But he was always a kid that wasn't a wise guy, but he picked out these wonderful words, and he just happened to get lucky every once in a while. Basically a failure, but on certain words he'd be right. And that's why I used Chester that way. It was a great, and still is, part of me. I mean, there's a great sadness, but fun in Chester. He's, well, it's like, you know, God is in my mind, the devil's in my pants. he was always, you know, hi, Sally. Hey, listen, I'll stop it, Chester. Stop pulling my hair. You have beautiful hair. And you know, you're a natural Scandinavian blonde. My mother has brownie mouse hair. She pays over $56. That's just in a tip to have it made blonde. You're a lovely person. I wish I had money to marry you. But I don't have a job Saturday. I got fired from Weber's grocery store. Otherwise, I could buy you that orphan any ring. You have too many boyfriends. Your mind is going to be crowded. And so that's pretty much Chester.
Are these characters still close to you? Do you still carry them around in your mind?
Oh, yes. I was an only child, and I didn't have any brothers or sisters. As I look back over my shoulder, I think, oh, God, maybe it was a blessing I didn't have a sister. I'm sure I would have been in there asking, you know, to see her robe, or could I try her shoes on. If I had a brother, he would have been beating me up and probably locking me in the furnace until spring.
Why would you have wanted to try your sister's clothes on?
Why? Oh, I think, well, to my knowledge, a lot of guys with sisters have wanted to do that, and vice versa. My mother used to put clothes on me, her clothes, and I almost went back to live with my father. They were divorced when I was 7. And then, strangely enough, he wanted to put my grandmother's dress on me. So it was a wild kind of thing. I just wanted to end up in a civilian conservation corps. I wanted to pick up, you know, pine cones and just live with bears.
I hope you don't mind my asking this. I know in 1959 you spent around 8 months in a sanitarium.
Mm.
And I was wondering if when you were there you were worried that the doctors would try to cure you of comedy and to cure you of all the characters in your head.
Well, I think lawyers cure you of comedy. doctors stare at you. They really don't know. They just, in fairness to doctors, they go, how are we feeling? I had a couple of weeks, and that was in 59. And then I realized I had to get some money. I owed some money to some people, and not relatives. They never had it. And certainly I never asked my mother and dad. These are car dealers. And so I had to get well quickly. There was no sense of my sitting around here. But I think I would give this much advice, if I may. And it's only from an outpatient. My insanity, I've been called crazy. And a woman the other day pointed at me, a very strong lady in army clothes. She'd come out of a 5 and 10 and she was in a camouflaged outfit. I think she was on her way to purchase a handgun, and she was quite strong. She was a truck driver, but she's a very, very strong woman. Probably lived in Russia, you know, in the north. But she said, you know, you're crazy. And I said, yes, I think I'm aware of that. It's always overly sensitive people like yourself that spot us. Went right past her. I don't know. I've always enjoyed my craziness. I made it go to work for me. I just didn't sit down beside chicken wire or iron. I decided that this was my role, and I got to do something about it. And I think the thing is to just do the best you can and bring a little laughter. If you don't, you know, a guy out in California today, a UCLA graduate, said to me, doing a paper, what are you afraid of the most? Which is a very, very heavy question. There are so many things. I'm almost now completely paranoid. I'm afraid of everything. And if I see a shadow, I think it's time to go. If I see a bird, I know it's going to attack me. If it's a beggar, I'm sure that if I put something in the cup, it'll blow up. Both of us will have to go. He's probably a Buddhist. But at any rate, I said, I'm scared to death of a man or a woman without a sense of humor. Because to me, if you don't have that, then I'm really frightened. And there are a surprising amount of people out there that don't have a sense of humor.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life. Thank you very
well,
much.
Well, thank you, and I hope to see you. You're in Washington now?
Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Well, I'll come by at an odd hour, my dear.
Right.
Probably crawl up the... Are you in a house or in an apartment?
The radio station.
I'll find you.
Okay,
if you see little funny suction cups and a man smiling at the damnedest hour, it's me.
I'll be looking.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye, and thank you.
Thank you.
Comic and painter Jonathan Winters. This is Fresh Air. Let's get the latest on what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
What's coming up?
Well, we'll have news about closing arguments in the Oliver North trial. We'll be hearing about the fighting in Beirut and some guide to who the different factions are, the different militias involved in it. Also, we'll be hearing from Ted Clark about Japan's foreign aid program and why some Americans feel that the Japanese, in giving aid to a lot of third world countries, are perhaps more interested, or at least equally interested, in creating markets for their own exports. We'll also have a guide from John Burnett to some of the mystical practices that seem to have been at work in the Matamoros killings.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Christa Wolf is an East German journalist and author whose latest novel is called Accident, A Day's News. It's a meditation on one day's events, which include hearing about the nuclear accident at Chernobyl. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
In her several remarkable books, The Quest for Christa T, A Model Childhood, No Place on Earth, and Cassandra, Christa Wolf grudges the reader every inch of intimacy. She'll not be understood too quickly. She's almost always autobiographical and self-conscious about it and suspicious of her self-consciousness, like a Doris Lessing. Out of these suspicions, like a Simone de Beauvoir, she spins theories, spiderwebs on what it means to be a woman and a German, a mother and a Marxist, a child of Hitler and a writer against the world, and then cuts through these theories with a sword. They aren't good enough. They are too fancy. They can't hold the blood. There is about her simultaneously both a weariness of the old European culture that she'd rather shrug off, like Monique Wittig, and also the primary colors of Joan Didion's paranoia, as if history were her migraine headache. This sounds grim, and it is grim much of the time. And yet somehow, against all odds, she manages to be lyrical. She'll pierce the heart. If you haven't read Cassandra, you'll find the appendix as compelling as the novel. The novel reimagines the Trojan War from the point of view of its first victim. The appendix consists of essays on patriarchal drama since the Greeks, the blood-red thread of narrative, the hero plot, the epic quest of men for profit, property, and glory, at the expense of the women's choral song of seasons and renewal. Accident is the story of a day in the life of an East German writer named Christa. She fears, on the one hand, a possible meltdown of the nuclear reactor after the accident at Chernobyl. She fears, on the other hand, her brother's death. He is being operated on for a brain tumor. She gardens before the orchards are poisoned. She bicycles before the walls come down. She answers her mail before her friends have time to die. She is bothered by neighbors and the telephone. She seems to have read too much Conrad Lorenz on ethology, too much Arthur Koestler on the neocortex of the brain, too many fairy tales from the Brothers Grimm about dark forests and wild beasts and wicked stepmothers. We are bent on waste and friendless, greedy death, she says. Physics and ideology, murder to create. She postulates a blind spot somewhere in our evolution, a heart of darkness that accounts for evil, and this before she's even looked at the Joseph Conrad novel on her bedside table. If she were a carpenter, she might find this heart of darkness in her tools, her axe, her nails. Because she's a novelist, she suspects the problem is language itself, the gift of speech we should have refused, the vice of writing that is her solitary practice, quote, the cordon of word nausea becoming ever denser that tightens on her neck. Deep in such sorrow, she accuses herself and despairs of light. But I'll be damned if she doesn't find some, a flicker up in clouds above an unknown continent, down in a wisdom as secret and deep as the kinship of silent trees and stones, in a dream in which a monster cries, on a moon that wears her mother's face. She finds something, an accident of grace, and that's enough.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Christa Wolf's new novel, Accident, A Day's News. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Robert Ludlum talks about writing best-selling espionage novels and voicing tuna helper commercials, or was it hamburger helper? He doesn't really remember. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new Smithsonian collection of American musical comedy, and critic Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of I Want to Hold Your Hand. It's the 1978 movie about a group of young Beatle fanatics, and it was directed by Robert Zemeckis, who also directed Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Back to the Future. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Ed Doherty, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Deborah Beagle and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Audrey Vablitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.